Well, thank you for the warm welcome. It is a great joy to be with you. My wife Jacqueline and I, we've been enjoying a wonderful sabbatical at Oxford University, and we've been here since January, and we'll be staying till June, and it's been a great delight to meet so many wonderful people here in England, and thank you for the opportunity to be in your midst. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Erica, for the welcome. Thank you, Keith, for helping to organize this, and all the others who have been involved in the planning for our coming. I'll be speaking tonight on a topic that perhaps is not, perhaps sounds familiar to us, but I'm going to go a little bit beneath the surface to explore what the Christian faith has actually wrought in Western civilization, primarily. Because the Christian faith often gets a bad rap for all sorts of abuses, as though the Christian faith or the teachings of Jesus more specifically are responsible for that. I would say a lot of the complaints come because the teachings of Jesus have been not represented or misrepresented or completely ignored. And so I want to explore this topic in significant detail. Probably are familiar with the New Atheist, Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, who wrote a book, God is Not Great. Of course, the call to prayer in the mosque is Allahu Akbar, God is great, or God is greater. And here Christopher Hitchens is saying, God is not great. And he talks about how religion has poisoned everything. The problem with this understanding of, or this critique, is that religion is typically misunderstood, or it's a catch-all term, and people don't really understand what it's about. Martin Marty, by the way, there's an arrow there, and my wife Jacqueline and two of our kids, we met Martin Marty at a conference, and so there he is in all of his glory. But he said that there is this expert and authority on religion at the University of Chicago, and he said that there are at least 17 distinct definitions of religion, and that scholars will never agree on any definition. So if you're going to critique religion, maybe we should be clear on what term we're actually talking about, what it actually means. But unfortunately, this is a kind of elusive topic for so many, because it is, again, this catch-all term. I would argue that it's better to talk about worldview rather than I'm religious or I'm not religious, because everyone has a worldview. Everyone has a view about the nature of ultimate reality, about right and wrong, ethics, about knowledge, whether we can know, or epistemology. And it shouldn't simply be taken for granted that this is the default position, as a lot of atheists or skeptics or, quote, secularists tend to do. No, they hold certain views, and the question is, how do you justify the beliefs that you hold? So we shouldn't simply assume a viewpoint, but we ought to be able to give justification for it. Also, we need to keep in mind, contrary to Christopher Hitchens, who seemed to want to deny that atheism has done anything wrong, no, actually, atheism has done a lot of poisoning. You think of Stalin, you think of Mao Zedong, and Pol Pot. In fact, my grandfather from the Ukraine, my father came from the Ukraine, his father died of starvation through the Stalinist forced collectivization and famine in the Ukraine. 8 to 12 million people who died through him, 70 million under Mao Zedong. Also, we need to remember that not all traditional religions are created equal, if we can put it that way. You think of the caste system in Hinduism, or some of its deities that are the male deities that are abusive toward females. We'll come back to that. Also, we need to remember that we're not denying that bad things have been done in the name of God. In fact, Jesus predicted this. He said, "Many will come in my name," Matthew 7. Saying, "Lord, didn't we do all these things, prophesy, cast out demons, perform miracles in your name?" And Jesus will say, "Depart from me, I never knew you, you workers of lawlessness." So yeah, a lot of people will do all sorts of terrible things in the name of Jesus, but Jesus doesn't give his stamp of approval to those things. Also, we need to remember that the Bible makes clear our own profound human sinfulness and selfish orientation, and our proneness to self-deception. So it's not as though, even the best examples of the Christian faith will still struggle with sin. There is still, our human fallenness that we have to grapple with. So we need to offer some qualifications here. Furthermore, I think it's helpful to consider that people who call themselves Christians, especially in a place where it's easy to call oneself a Christian, that this is not really a very telling thing. That I think it's very helpful for us to remember that where it costs you something to call yourself a Christian, maybe we should consider that as more appropriate a category than where it's easy to call yourself a Christian and maybe live like a relativist. But what I want to focus on is what happens when people faithfully follow Jesus Christ, when they are consistently living out the message of the gospel, not simply wearing a Christian label. That is what I want to focus on. And part of my emphasis is going to be that many of us are like this child sitting on a lots of money. We're kind of like cultural trust fund kids, that we are heirs to hard-fought gains that have been brought to us by courageous and dedicated Christians who have been following Jesus faithfully. A lot of us take this for granted, and so we're going to come back to this theme. So here's an overview of where we're going to go tonight. First, I want to look at India in particular and Hinduism and the status and treatment of women within Hinduism. And then looking at how worldviews work and using this model of roots, shoots, and fruits. That is, how a certain perspective, a certain voice that we listen to, shapes a worldview and then yields certain fruits, whether good or bad. And then I want to talk about how faithful Jesus followers have shaped Western culture through modern science, bioethics, human rights, and democracy, and also the reinforcement by non-theistic scholars, people who don't believe in God, but that recognize the direct impact, the pervasive, leavening influence that the Christian faith has had in Western civilization and other parts of the world. So with that in mind, let's move forward to talk about India. So with unperturbed pace, deliberate speed, and majestic instancy, we move forward. Hinduism and the status and treatment of women. There had been in India back in 2012 a 23-year-old physical therapist student nearby who was gang raped and brutalized on a public bus in Mumbai, India, and died as a result. And this created a great outrage. Nearby was from a high caste in India. And so this created a great sense of shock. How could this happen in India? Well, as it turns out, this has happened. It happens quite a lot in India, but it's not as high profile because this is done with the lower caste women all the time. This journalist, Kansha Ilaya, in his article, The Roots of Rape in India, says some very interesting things. Again, speaking as an Indian from his own, from this own, this Indian context, he says, rape has of late become an acute disease in the Indian society. Prima facie, this is the problem arising out of a mental disorder that is on the face of it. It seems like, oh, something's wrong mentally with this person. But there's also a larger cultural context that, to an extent, explains how the Indian male became so brutal. He goes on to say, daily reports of infants being raped across the length and breadth of a country is a phenomenon unique to India, a society that's otherwise highly conservative. Clearly, the institutional upbringing, including that in family, needs to undergo change. He adds, we cannot leave it entirely to the police or to the judiciary to tackle such heinous acts, for rape is also a cultural problem, and it is a more serious problem because of the extermination of the victim. We need to treat the malaise from its very roots. He says, here is a problem. There is no appreciation per se of a healthy man-woman relationship, which is rooted in the concept of equality. This is not something to be glossed over. that it's though some superficial issue. It's actually rooted in Hindu theology. He says we have the god Shiva, who insisted on entering the bathing arena of the goddess Parvati, and did so by eliminating a child who was keeping guard at the open door. Lord Krishna stole the clothes of women while they were bathing in the Yamuna River. He did so to tease them for the pleasure of watching the beauty of their naked bodies. He says, we hang miniature paintings of the same act in our homes proudly. The young men who grow up seeing this or listening to the story told in an amused tone are bound not to find such an act abhorrent. He says, our mythology tells us that what a husband does is right, that his will is greater than the woman's. If a mythological hero is praised for his acts of killing, drinking, and fornicating with multiple women, it is glorification of such behavior. One Supreme Court judge in India, Ram Jethmalani, he caused quite a furor when he, commenting on the god after whom he is named, said, Ram was a bad husband. I don't like him at all. This god Ram had this virtuous wife Sita, whom he sent into exile because he believed the slander of a washer or maybe fisherman, and did not trust in her, but rather believed some stranger, and wanted to be popular in the eyes of those who were looking upon him. Fundamentally, when you look at Hindu theology, Hindu male deities when they engage with women, it is to strike or curse them or to use them as sexual objects. So this is drawing a bit of a contrast here, and I want to now bring it to the issue of the worldview. We talked about religion, but we want to focus on worldview because a worldview is a way that we view the world, the nature of reality, the nature of right and wrong, knowledge and so forth. And I want to look at this theme of roots, shoots, and fruits because I think this is going to be useful in our understanding of how to move forward in our thinking about this issue. The impact of model voices on culture. A friend of mine, Tom Wolfe, has talked about, he's a sociologist, he says that while all cultures are sick, he says some are sicker than others. That there's no culture is beyond reproach or above critique. But there may be some that have more favorable, more desirable qualities from an objective point of view than others. Why are some cultures more change-prone instead of change-resistant, for example? And when it comes to, and Tom Wolfe has lived in India for over a decade, and he asks, how does one change such a mindset that diminishes or denigrates women and the girl child, or could even change a caste system? Well, we learn from the Roman writer Tacitus that merely multiplying laws is going to be inadequate. He says, the more corrupt the republic, the more laws. In other words, once character is no longer able to sustain human flourishing in a society, you're going to have to prop it up with laws and maybe a more of a police state in order to reinforce them. But he says that a more profound and pervasive transformation is going to be required in order to bring about this kind of a change in mindset. So what do we mean by roots, shoots, and fruits? And we've touched on this a little bit, but Tom Wolfe in this rubric mentions, first of all, the world voice. What is the voice that we listen to? The voice of Jesus, maybe. The voice of Muhammad or Buddha or Shiva or Marx. Well, this is the spokesperson, the person to whom we look or even worship, and informs us about how we go about our lives. And this leads us to the worldview, the philosophical, quote, religious or intellectual precepts, about what the nature of reality is, about how we should act, about knowledge, about the purpose of life and so forth. And then finally, the world venue. That is the fruits of our own worldview. What is the logical outcome of the particular worldview that we hold? What is the logical outcome of that world voice that is being articulated that shapes a worldview and then leads to certain fruits and these customs and practices? Well, there is, say, a biblical voice that begins that God created human beings in his image, male and female, that there is a fundamental equality between male and female. Jesus, of course, talks about the fundamental equality of all, and he says that in everything, treat people the same way you would want them to treat you, for this is the law and the prophets. Basically, another way of articulating, love your neighbor as yourself. So that's the biblical voice, or those are biblical voices. But within Hinduism, the leading voice, the book of Manu that has shaped Hinduism, is that not all are created equal. And so you have a certain structure to Hinduism, to Hindu society, and that there are some at the top, like the Brahmins, and then there are those who don't even have any caste at all. Those are the Dalits. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi, people see him as a great reformer, brought about great things. Well, actually, Mahatma Gandhi had his own views of those who were these untouchables. He says that the vast masses of Harijans, it means children of God, these Dalits are untouchables, and for that matter of Indian humanity, cannot understand the presentation of Christianity. He says they can no more distinguish between the relative merits of worldviews than can a cow. Harijans have no mind, no intelligence, no sense of difference between God and no God. I haven't heard that quotation from Gandhi. author from India talks about how 60 million missing women are in India, largely through gendercide. That is, when abortion takes place, it is largely to take the lives of unborn girls. And that when this book was written, that males outnumber females by 37 million in India. This great disproportion, a disregard for the female in Indian society. And again, this has been well documented. The International Center for Research on Women and the United Nations Population Fund talk about rape within marriage. 60% of men said that they'd use some form of violence to assert dominance over their partners. The UN Special Rapporteur's Mission Report in 2014 talked about violence against women in India as systemic and occurring in public and private spheres. Women are discriminated against and subordinated not only on the basis of sex, but on other grounds, caste, class, ability, sexual orientation, tradition, and other realities. And of course, this leads to all sorts of violence against them, from the womb to the tomb, they say. And it says that the manifestations of violence against women are a reflection of the structural and institutional inequality that is a reality for most women in India. Sexual violence, including rape and sexual harassment, is widespread across the country and perpetrated in public and private spaces. Women are easy targets of attacks, including sexual violence, whether while using public transportation, sanitation, and so forth. Many victims of sexual violence carry a deep sense of shame, which is further exacerbated by the stigma and exclusion they experience, especially from family members in the community from which may result in suicide. Rape was most highly reported among Dalit or no-caste women. So this is a fundamental problem. What I'm pointing out here is that there seems to be a connection between the theology of Hinduism and this kind of an outcome, that there is this consistency between the worldview and the world venue or the fruits that come from that world voice. What I want to do now is shift a little bit to this theme of how faithful Jesus followers help transform culture, how they help now, but how they have helped in the past. And it will highlight how the worldview actually takes effect in individuals' lives, those who have been touched by the gospel of Jesus Christ. A friend of mine, Ian Proven, says that we are presently living off the fumes of Christendom, largely shaped by persons dedicated to living out the biblical message. We are, as it were, living in a house that has been structured, wired, plumbing installed, all the right fixtures in place. And we go on, flip on the light switch, flush the toilet, open the refrigerator and so forth. Everything is there working, and we take the structure for granted. But we have forgotten, as Westerners, what actually laid those foundations, what actually built that house that has made our lives fairly comfortable, much more livable, much more conducive to human flourishing. The historian from Yale, Wayne Meeks, says that the first urban Christians who were resocialized through conversion, they experienced the intimacy of Christian groups as a welcome refuge. They used the emotion-charged language of family and affection. They believed that they were made in the image of a caring and personal God, and that the master symbol of the crucified Savior shaped their understanding of reality. And it says these themes crystallized a believable picture of the way the world really seemed to work. So when you go into an early church community and you see what is going on there, you will, and again, as we read the writings of the New Testament, we read that the earliest Christians of all social strata, master and slave, Jew and Gentile, male and female, were exhorted to greet one another with a holy kiss. It's very interesting that in Romans chapter 16, Andronicus and Urbanus, two common slave names, they are mentioned as fellow workers of the Apostle Paul who wrote this letter. And then in Romans 16, where their names appear, Paul says to greet one another, including those slaves, those who had this low status in Roman society, to greet one another with a holy kiss, a picture of love and family affection. Furthermore, slave and master alike would sit together at the same table, sharing not only a meal together, but then the Lord's Supper afterwards, that they would sit as equals, as family in this spiritual community. They would call one another brother and sister. And after all, they had been adopted by their heavenly Father through the crucified and self-sacrificing Master and Savior Jesus Christ. As we continue on from the first century to the second century, there is this letter written, an anonymous letter, the epistle to Diognetus, where it says these Christians dwell in their own countries, but simply as sojourners. As citizens, they share in all things with others, and yet endure all things as if foreigners. They have a common table, but not a common bed. They are in the flesh, but they do not live after the flesh. They pass their days on earth, but they are citizens of heaven. They obey the prescribed laws, but at the same time surpass the laws by their lives. They love all men and are persecuted by all. They are unknown and condemned. They are put to death and restored to life. They are poor, yet make many rich. They are in lack of all things, yet abound in all. They are dishonored, and yet in their very dishonor are glorified. What a wonderful description of those early Christians. Well, we get to the fourth century, and there's Emperor Julian the Apostate, who was very hostile toward Christians, but he was very disturbed by the fact that Christians were sterling citizens within the Roman Empire. It is their Christian benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, and the pretended holiness of their lives that have done the most to increase atheism, that is, disbelief in these pagan deities. The impious Galileans support, that is, these Christians, support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us. So they were living in a very powerful way, according to the teachings of Jesus that really showed up those who were around them, and much to the dismay of Julian the Apostate. I'm going to eventually talk about the Protestant Reformation and what that brought, but we also need to remember that even before the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century, in fact, it's the 500th anniversary this year, We should remember that many reforms and that were inspired by the Christian faith took place both in the ancient world and in the Middle Ages. What were some of these? Well, if you can, and you can read at length in this book by Alvin Schmidt, How Christianity Changed the World. But here are just a few things that that took place. For example, after 313, Constantine, with his coming to power, he outlawed gladiatorial games, prohibited child abandonment and infanticide. There are also the creation of hospices, and also the creation of hospitals motivated by Jesus' words, I was sick, and you looked after me. There are also missionary endeavors, and we just recently celebrated St. Patrick's Day, who was involved in church planting. This St. Patrick, who was brought up in England, was captured by pirates, was in Ireland. He escaped, came back to England, and then was converted, and then went back to Ireland to share the good news of the gospel that he had experienced, and ended up planting 700 churches, ordaining up to 1,000 priests, and 150 Celtic tribes becoming largely Christianized. We also see that there's the copying and preservation of manuscripts and the promotion of learning. For example, the establishing of universities and centers of learning. We also have much technological advancement, horsepower, horseshoe, harnessing, water power, wheelbarrow, eyeglasses, clocks, and so forth. And one social historian said the chief glory of the later Middle Ages was not its cathedrals or its scholasticism. It was the building for the first time in history of a complex civilization, which, note this, rested not on the backs of sweating slaves or coolies, but primarily on non-human power. At a conference in Oxford in 1961, the conclusion summarized by the historian Ernst Benz said that Christian beliefs provided the rationale and faith the motive energy for Western technology. In other words, trying to treat people in a way that honored their being made in the image of God. Well, we come to the 16th century and the Protestant Reformation and greater gains that came through this movement. What do we have? We have actually the democratizing roots of this movement with three core values that transformed many lives and communities. The first conviction was the priesthood of all believers, that all believers can approach God without the need for some mediator. Jesus is the sufficient mediator between human beings and God, and therefore we can approach God without the need for a priest to go on our behalf. There's also the emphasis on the right of every believer to study the Bible for himself in his own language. And of course, Martin Luther translated the Bible into the vernacular, into German, and made it accessible for the common person who didn't understand Latin, the academic language. And then finally, the appropriateness of pursuing any honest vocation to the glory of God. That those were three core values emphasized within the Protestant Reformation, and the impact was dramatic. One sociologist at the National University of Singapore, Robert Woodbury, wrote an article in the American Political Science Review called The Missionary Roots of Liberal Democracy. And he talks about the various gains that came through the Protestant Reformation. He talks about these conversionary Protestants or missionaries who were responsible for bringing these gains to other parts of the world. He talks about, and he well documents, the development and spread of religious liberty, mass education, mass printing, volunteer organizations, most major colonial reforms. That is, in other words, missionaries weren't the ones, these Protestant missionaries weren't bringing, quote, colonialism. They're actually often a buffer within these settings between the colonial powers and the indigenous peoples. They abolished slavery, widow burning, foot binding in China, female circumcision, prepubescent marriage of girls, etc. And also the codification of legal protections for non-whites in the 19th and early 20th centuries. He says areas where Protestant missionaries had a significant presence in the past are on average, get this, more economically developed today with comparatively better health, lower infant mortality, lower corruption, greater literacy, higher educational attainment, especially for women, and more robust membership in non-governmental organizations. There's more. These Protestant missionaries were often selected as judges to punish or reprimand military officials or magistrates for murder, seizing land, forced labor, and so forth. And they sought to apply the same legal standards for whites and non-whites in these settings. And they documented colonial atrocities through detailed information and eventually through photos. Robert Woodbury writes, "Without Protestant missionaries and ministers mobilizing mass protests, mass protests would have been difficult to get going. But these missionaries helped create a kind of cocoon in which nonviolent indigenous political movements could develop to press for democracy and decolonialization." Robert Woodbury issues this challenge, described in a more popular article written by Andrea Dilley. He says, "Look at any map where Protestant missionaries have been, and you'll find more printed books and more schools per capita. And you'll discover that in Africa, the Middle East, and parts of Asia, most of the early nationalists who led their countries to independence graduated from Protestant mission schools." His thesis is that Protestant missionaries were the moral and social change agents, and this is held up under rigorous academic scrutiny. Various scholars like Rodney Stark, Philip Jenkins, the historian, sociologist Christian Smith, find this thesis very convincing, using all the available variables to test this thesis. In fact, the American Political Science Review required of this author, Robert Woodbury, 192 pages, additional pages of supporting documentation. And his article has received prestigious awards. And so this is, again, something that is not just some wacko who is writing, but someone who has actually distinguished himself in being able to defend, with plenty of documentation, this thesis that some took as controversial, but they couldn't argue against the evidence. The statistical evidence also indicates a Protestantism-democracy association. Protestantism, he argues, facilitated the development of modern representative democracy. Stable democracy, he says, first emerged in Protestant Europe and British settler colonies. By World War I, every independent, predominantly Protestant country was a stable democracy, with the possible exception of Germany. Less stable versions of democracy developed in Catholic areas with large Protestant and Jansenist minorities, such as in France. And then he talks about how in Catholic and Orthodox parts of Southern and Eastern Europe, that kind of stability of democracy did not take place because, he argues, the diminished influence of Protestantism there. The atheist historian who taught at Oxford is now at the Hoover Institute and Stanford University. Niall Ferguson says that there is a connection between Protestantism and, he argues, a strong work ethic, along with other killer apps that are part of Western civilization, including science, modern medicine, property rights, a free market, and so forth. But we can add other things to this list in which the Christian faith has contributed distinctively to the world. We can talk about modern science. Modern science had its foundations in a biblical worldview, and those who were the founders of modern science, you know, those leading lights like Newton, Kepler, Copernicus, and so forth, these were dedicated believers, Bible believers. They believed in miracles. They believed in design. They also believed that God created human beings to study the world, that it was a good thing to do. In fact, J.J. Thomson, who taught physics at Cambridge University, had this verse over the door of the Cavendish Laboratory. "Great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by all who delight in them." The physicist Paul Davies says that science began as an outgrowth of theology, and all scientists, whether atheists or theists, accept an essentially theological, that is biblical in this case, worldview. The sociologist Rodney Stark says the roots of science have rested entirely on religious foundations, and the people who brought it about were devout Christians. It's kind of ironic how that's been twisted to the assumption today that faith and science, the Christian faith and science, are somehow inherently in conflict. Bioethics. Daniel Callahan, the founding father of the bioethics movement, which sought to protect individual human beings from the encroachments of technology and science as they impinged on medicine. He says, when I first became interested in bioethics in the mid-1960s, the only resources were theological or those drawn from within the traditions of medicine, themselves heavily shaped by religion. We come to human rights. The Declaration of Independence of the United States. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is a more classical sense that, say, Aristotle would use, that it is the pursuit of well-being or flourishing. France's Declaration of Human Rights makes this connection between God and human rights as well, that these rights were affirmed in the presence and under the auspices of the supreme being. In the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, there is this inherent dignity that is assumed, and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family. Well, who was behind this human rights declaration? Well, Marianne Glendon of Harvard University says that the chief movers to create this new world order in light of the Nazi and Japanese atrocities were largely church coalitions, individual Christian leaders who worked with some Jewish rabbis. Those are the ones who formed and forged this very important document outlining the rights of all human beings. The Princeton scholar Max Stackhouse says, intellectual honesty demands recognition of the fact that what passes as secular Western principles of basic human rights developed nowhere else than out of the key strands of the biblically rooted religion. Now, some people might say, well, you're missing a few possible explanations for how this emphasis on human rights and democracy could come about. What about, for example, Greek democracy? What about the Renaissance? What about Enlightenment influences? What about these factors? Couldn't that be explained by these movements? Well, when it comes to democracy and ancient Greece, this actually is more like a hierarchical society. And Plato and Aristotle believed that slaves were such by nature. Aristotle said that some humans are simply animated tools, that they're born this way, and that there's no way that they could ever rule in as philosopher kings. Of course, Plato used that language. The philosopher and agnostic Luc Ferry says that we should not forget that in Greek city-states, these were founded on slavery. Some men are born to command, others to obey, which is why Greek political life accommodates itself easily to the notion of slavery. What about the Renaissance? That's clearly not Greek democracy. It certainly is not anything related to what we know today. But the Renaissance scholar Paul Oscar Christeller says that the humanism of the Renaissance was more like, it should be understood as the humanities. It was an educational program rather than some sort of a deviation from the Christian faith. He says that humanism was in its core neither religious nor anti-religious, but a literary and scholarly orientation. In fact, the historian Jacques Barzan says that the Renaissance humanists remained deeply religious, and that they were no more pagan than the Puritan poet John Milton was when he used these pagan references in his own writings. Well, what about the Enlightenment? Now, my wife and I were just in Paris a couple of weeks ago, and we went to see the Pantheon, where a number of these leading lights like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Voltaire were buried. And the question comes up: what about some of these figures? Weren't they pressing for human rights and democracy and so forth? Well, yes, they were, but actually, many of them were informed by the Christian faith and Protestantism in particular. In fact, some of the leading lights in the in the Enlightenment movement were from a Protestant Calvinist education. Hugo Grotius, John Locke, Rousseau, Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, Patrick Henry, etc. And we can also talk about how Puritans and Protestant nonconformists, they were using the Bible to talk about compacts and social contracts well before that had become part of the philosophical dialogue or political dialogue through Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. The historian Stephen Hopgood says that the emphasis on human rights is basically a kind of corruption of what is actually the biblical theme of human beings being made in the image of God. It's a secular replacement for the Christian God, he said. Now, this gets very interesting here. The historian and author Tom Holland concedes this about his own experience. He says, "Why I was wrong about Christianity." I'm going to read this at length. But this is what he says about his own discovery as he looked at the at classical antiquity, the Greco-Roman world. He says, "The longer I spent immersed in the study of classical antiquity, the more alien and unsettling I came to find it. It was not just the extremes of callousness that I came to find shocking, but the lack of a sense that the poor or the weak might have any intrinsic value. As such, the founding conviction of the Enlightenment, that it owed nothing to the faith into which most of its greatest figures had been born, increasingly came to seem to me unsustainable." "Every sensible man," Voltaire wrote, "every honorable man must hold the Christian sect in horror. Yet Voltaire, in his concern for the weak and oppressed, was marked more enduringly by the stamp of biblical ethics than he cared to admit. We preach Christ crucified, St. Paul declared, unto Jews a stumbling block and unto the Greeks foolishness." He was right. Nothing could have run more counter to the most profoundly held assumptions of Paul's contemporaries, Jews and Greeks or Romans. The notion that a God, get this, the notion that a God might have suffered torture and death on a cross was so shocking as to appear repulsive. Familiarity with the biblical narrative of the crucifixion has dulled our sense of just how completely novel a deity Christ was. In the ancient world, it was the role of God who laid claim to ruling the universe to uphold its order by inflicting punishment, not to suffer it themselves. Today, even as the belief in God fades across the West, the countries that were once collectively known as Christendom continue to bear the stamp of the 2-millennia-old revolution that Christianity represents. It is the principal reason why, by and large, most of us who live in post-Christian societies still take for granted that it is nobler to suffer than to inflict suffering. It is why we generally assume that every human life is of equal value. In my morals and ethics, I have learned to accept that I am not Greek or Roman at all, but thoroughly and proudly Christian. Well, this is not the only representative who will speak that way of discovering that actually the Greco-Roman world doesn't represent the kind of values that we take for granted today, but rather it's the Christian faith that has done so. Here are a few other representatives. Non-theists who acknowledge the human rights origins come from a biblical worldview. Jürgen Habermas talks about this. "Christianity has functioned for the normative self-understanding of modernity as more than just a precursor or catalyst." Get these descriptions. "Egalitarian universalism, from which sprang the ideas of freedom and the social solidarity, an autonomous conduct of life and emancipation, the individual morality of conscience, human rights, and democracy, is the direct heir to the Judaic ethic of justice and the Christian ethic of love." He says when it comes to accounting for this, he says there is no challenge to this. He says, you know, we continue to draw on the substance of this heritage. Everything else is just idle postmodern talk. There is no alternative interpretation to this, he says. The atheist thinker Jacques Derrida, the deconstructionist guy, he says, "Today the cornerstone of international law is the sacred. What is sacred in humanity? You should not kill. You should not be responsible for a crime against this sacredness." He says, in that sense, the concept of crime against humanity is a Christian concept. And I think there would be no such thing in the law today without the Christian heritage, the Abrahamic heritage, the biblical heritage. The agnostic philosopher Luc Ferry says, "The Christian idea of human equality was unprecedented at the time and one to which our world owes its entire democratic inheritance." Also in China, this was recognized. The Time correspondent David Aikman tells of a Chinese lecturer from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences who was speaking to a group of American tourists, and this is what he said. "One of the things we were asked to look into was what accounted for the success, in fact, the preeminence of the West all over the world. We studied everything we could from historical, political, economic, and cultural perspectives. At first, we thought it was because you had more powerful guns than we had. Then we thought it was because you had the best political system. Next, we focused on your economic system. But in the past 20 years, we have realized that at the heart of your culture is your religion, Christianity. That is why the West has been so powerful. The Christian moral foundation of social and cultural life was what made possible the emergence of capitalism and then the successful transition to democratic politics. We don't have any doubt about this." And I should add that it's through capitalism, the free market, that hundreds of millions of people, both in China and in India, have come out of poverty. We can talk about that later if you like. But the agnostic political scientist Gunter Levy at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst says that adherents of a naturalistic ethic are not likely to produce a Dorothy Day, a social reformer in the Catholic tradition, or a Mother Teresa. "Many of these people love humanity, but not individual human beings with all their failings and shortcomings. They will be found participating in demonstrations for causes such as nuclear disarmament, but not sitting at the bedside of a dying person." An ethic of moral autonomy and individual rights, so important to secular liberals, is incapable of sustaining and nourishing values such as altruism and self-sacrifice. That worldview that shapes a life, that transforms a life, that leads to these sorts of fruits makes a lot more sense if you understand that there is a Savior, Jesus Christ, God incarnate, who comes into this world to give himself, to die for us, to suffer on our behalf. That transforms, that brings about a new understanding of reality. Then agnostic journalist Malcolm Muggeridge talked about this when he was in India and Africa. He says, I witnessed much righteous endeavor undertaken by Christians of all denominations. However, I never, as it happens, came across a hospital or orphanage run by the Fabian, the socialist society, or a humanist leper colony. Well, we can jump to the modern era, where we talk about a more contemporary story about the Ebola virus. Brian Palmer, an atheist who wrote in Medicine We Trust, he says, "Should we worry that so many of the doctors treating Ebola in Africa are missionaries?" And this is what he writes. He says, he talks about this difference between missionaries and Western merchants. He says, "Missionaries don't profit personally from their work. They're compensated very poorly, if at all. Many risk their lives. How many people would risk death to spread the gospel of Western consumer goods gratis?" He says, "As an atheist, I try to make choices based on evidence and reason." It's not as though the Christian doesn't believe in evidence and reason. Far from it. At least that should be the case. He says, "So until we're ready to invest heavily in secular medicine for Africa, I suggest we stand aside and let God do his work." Here's another who reports about his own experience, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation journalist Brian Stewart. Listen to what he says. Listen to what his experience has been. He says, "I found that there is no movement or force closer to the raw truth of war, famines, crises, and the vast human predicament than organized Christianity in action. And there is no alliance more determined and dogged in action than church workers, ordained and lay members, when mobilized for a common good. It is these Christians who are right on the front lines of committed humanity today. And when I want to find that front, I follow their trail. It is a vast front stretching from the most impoverished reaches of the developing world to the hectic struggle to preserve caring values in our own towns and cities. I've never been able to reach these front lines without finding Christian volunteers already in the thick of it, mobilizing congregations that care, and being a faithful witness to truth, the primary light in the darkness, and so often the only light. Now, I came to this admiring view slowly and reluctantly. At the start of my career, I'd largely abandoned religion, for I too regarded the church as a rather tiresome irrelevance. What ultimately persuaded me otherwise, and I took a lot of persuading, was the reality of Christianity's mission, physically and in spirit, before my very eyes. I'm often asked if I lost belief in God covering events like Ethiopia, then called the worst hell on earth. Actually, like others before me, it was precisely in such hells that I rediscovered religion. I saw so many countless acts of human love and charity, total respect for the most forsaken, for all life. A few summary thoughts here. I think I need to be like the Egyptian mummy, being pressed for time. I need to wrap up quickly. So let me offer a few closing thoughts here. The Christian's faith that speaks of this positive historical impact doesn't actually itself prove that the Christian faith is true. But I would say that we have good reasons for talking about God's existence and also the evidence for, say, Jesus' bodily resurrection historically. But for God's existence, we can talk about the universe's beginning and fine-tuning, consciousness making better sense if God exists, a conscious being rather than our coming from non-conscious matter, or beauty and rationality and free will and moral duties and human dignity, that these make a lot more sense. These are not surprising. These are probable. These are likely if God exists, but not likely if God doesn't exist. But the topic is important for a world that is watching to see followers of Jesus hold more than intellectual beliefs, but live lives that bring transformation to individuals and communities. Jesus says, by their fruit, you will know them. Also, there's a marked difference between a Shiva or Krishna-shaped culture and a Jesus-shaped culture. Ask yourself the question, would you rather have your son become like Jesus or like Krishna? My friend Tom Wolfe has asked that question. In India, he'd say, would you want your son to become like Krishna or like Jesus? Like Krishna? Oh, no, that would be terrible. They don't want their son to turn out like Krishna. The good news of Jesus, of God who steps into our world and shares in our pain and suffering and misery, is profound and transformative, and that this is what has led to these sorts of changes in transformation of much of Western culture. The notion that a God, Tom Holland says, and we're just reviewing this again, the notion that a God might have suffered torture and death on a cross was so shocking as to appear repulsive in the first century. Familiarity with the biblical narrative of the crucifixion has dulled our sense of just how completely novel a deity Christ was. A few years ago, I wrote to the sociologist Rodney Stark at Baylor University, and in 2006, he had identified himself as an agnostic. So I had written to him, I think in 2011, and asked him, you identified yourself as an agnostic a few years ago. Where do you stand now? And he wrote back, and he said this in an email. He says, I basically wrote myself into the Christian faith. He identifies himself as a Christian now, and it is precisely because of these sorts of things, the impact, the transformation that the Christian faith has had in the West and also in so many parts of the world, that convinced him that this was not just some sort of a good intellectual idea, but that it was true. And so, Rodney Stark, like the reporter Brian Stewart and Tom Holland and others, have seen that it is indeed this Christian faith that has really shaped our thinking, and that there is no alternative explanation for how this mindset has been shaped except for that Christian faith. So just as we began, let me go back briefly to India. There is a reformer in India, not many people know about him, Mahatma Phule. In 1873, who had studied at this Scottish mission school in the 1840s, he considered Jesus, he called him the Bali Raja, sacrifice king. He says, the one great champion of the downtrodden, the holiest of the holy, the great sage and lover of truth, Baliraja, came into this world. And he says that followers of Baliraja came to India, preached and practiced the true teaching of their Messiah among the Shudras, that is the backward castes here. Thus they emancipated the Shudras from the unnatural and inhuman slavery which was imposed by the wicked Brahmins. In fact, he dedicated his book on slavery to the American people with great admiration for Abraham Lincoln. And so he wrote this book with an earnest desire that my countrymen may take their noble example as their guide in the emancipation of their backward caste brethren from the trammels of Brahmin thraldom. His own wife, the mother of education in India, had actually received a Gospel of John from a Scottish missionary. And this was the first book that she wanted to read after she was married and when her husband had taught her how to read. That this was what she longed for from 8 years old onward, that this was the first book that she wanted to read. She had become the mother of education in India. The author of the Indian Constitution, B.R. Ambedkar, burned the Book of Manu, which we had talked about at the beginning, which institutionalizes the caste system. He called this a holy lie. And he burned it on Christmas Day, 1927, which was an obvious connection to the Christian faith. He says, Hindu society seems to me to stand in need of a moral regeneration that is dangerous to postpone. Mahatma Gandhi himself, we can talk about him. He himself was anti-technological. The rejection of technology meant no running water and thus all manner of diseases that came with it. The caste system would create human wheelbarrows, some have called it, enslaving others to haul water or forcing them to carry excrement on their heads, which turned out to be something of an embarrassment to Gandhi, who seemed to be such a moral reformer. Here we see a story that depicts a common situation in the Dalit's life. In this case, the cleaning up of human excrement on the streets of India. One woman described her own experience as she would clean up excrement day after day in India. But her first day was described in this way. The first day when I was cleaning the latrines and the drain, my foot slipped in and my leg sank into the excrement up to my calf. I screamed and ran away. Then I came home and cried and cried. I knew that this was the only work for me. This was her lot. This was her karma. This is what she was, by this cosmic force, determined to do. And this is the caste system. My parents did this, my grandparents did this, and I've got to do this now. This is my lot, to clean up human excrement. I've mentioned my friend Tom Wolfe, who has a very dear friend who grew up in India, doing this very thing, sweeping the excrement, human excrement, off of the streets of India, picking it up, dumping it like this woman here was doing. But then he heard the story of a God who made all human beings equal, made them in his image, male and female, regardless of any sort of social station, all were equal before God. And furthermore, that there was this God sent his son into the world so that human beings might enter into a relationship with God, that they might enter into the family of God. And this message so transformed this friend of Tom Wolfe's, that he would eventually moved to the position where he could go to Oxford University to get his doctorate. And he, in a nutshell, he would put his testimony this way. He'd say, because of Hinduism, I used to sweep sheet. But because of Jesus, I went to Oxford University. And that is the power of Jesus Christ, of the gospel, to transform human lives, to transform indeed civilization, the civilization that many of us have simply taken for granted. Thanks very much for listening, and I look forward to engaging you with your questions.
Thank you very much, Paul, for a superbly delivered lecture and some extremely thought-provoking material within it. Give Paul a little bit of time to have a drink and recover. We have just one microphone in the middle. The acoustics here are not great, so if you do want to ask a question, I'd ask you to make your way to the microphone. I'll try and spread the questions around, so hopefully giving Paul a little bit of time to recover, you a bit of time to think. Who would like to ask the first question? Oh, please, Peter.
Allow me just to pitch in a googly to start things off. What would you say about the contribution to civilization that has come out of Islam? Because a lot of people trace back art and culture and mathematics and science to the Islamic faith. Just an overview in 30 seconds.
Yeah. There is a book written by Mark Deuce, I believe, and he's an Australian scholar who has studied Islam, and he talks about Islam, and it's called a Third Way. And in this book he describes, yes, some of the gains that Islamic civilization brought. I mean, right now I'm working on a co-edited anthology on the Kalam cosmological argument with William Lane Craig, who's actually delivered a lecture here at Highfield Church. And Islamic philosophers have contributed immensely to that valuable argument for the beginning of the universe, that there is a personal cause for the universe, that there is not only the reinforcement from science that comes through the Big Bang and the expanding universe and also the second law of thermodynamics, but there's also a philosophical argument against the possibility of an infinite temporal regress of events. So we can talk about their contributions in that way. They translated the works of Aristotle. They kept alive the works of Aristotle, in the Middle Ages when Aristotle was being ignored. So you do have great value in terms of cultural contributions, but they're also and we can talk about calligraphy and so forth. We can talk about architecture. My wife and I and a couple of years ago were at the Taj Mahal, and it certainly is a remarkable feature in the Indian landscape, this marvelous piece of architecture. Of course, the way that it was built, it was a lot of oppression that went along with it too, and it really didn't bring benefit to those who were building it. But you can talk about, yes, a lot of things of beauty, even the calligraphy on those buildings, very, very lovely. So there certainly is that kind of a contribution. But as this book, The Third Way, also documents, that a lot of the places where Islam went and conquered, it simply adopted many of, like Armenia and so forth, what had been Armenian art then became Islamic art and Islamic culture. And so it kind of assimilated a lot of these places where it had conquered. And so that we also need to keep that in mind. Yes, there are contributions independent of that, but there are also kind of assimilations that, in a sense, obscured the unique contributions of some of these other places that had been taken over by Islam, but yet simply adopted and assimilated and simply calling it Islamic art or whatever. So that's something that I would also want to highlight.
I generally agree with your viewpoint that Christianity was a catalyst for social reform. However, should Christianity not confess to its own sins? For instance, people would have enslaved people to part of the slave trade, and they were saving souls. Wasn't this great? The fact that they were shipping people out in slavery, neither here nor there. Or even today, I see American politics being co-opting the church, not necessarily obeying the teachings of Christ a lot of the time.
Well, I mean, there. Yeah, I don't know if I don't want to cut you off, but I think I know where you're going, and I'm not. I will certainly say, sure, there are a lot of things that those who have called themselves Christians ought to confess, ought to repent from, and certainly, I think it's helpful to note. Is this the sort of thing that Jesus would be endorsing? I think we ought to ask those kinds of questions. A lot of things that have been done in the name of Jesus certainly are, Jesus would find, again, horrible, evil, sinful, etc. So I would certainly agree that things like slavery or the Inquisition and so forth, that these were wrongs done in the name of Jesus, and Jesus himself said, yes, many will come in my name doing these sorts of things, and by their fruits you'll know them. So I would, I think that there is an appropriate distancing of those things that are that don't reflect the spirit of Christ. And yes, Christians ought to, professing Christians, that there ought to be an acknowledgement of those inconsistencies. So there's no real substantive argument here, but in terms of abuses done in the name of Jesus, and that there are certain things that need to be acknowledged and confessed and seen as out of keeping with the teachings of Jesus. Yeah, thank you.
I see the next speaker was pausing to reconsider the question, so please.
Hi, I had a similar question. So, regarding the evils that were done in the name of Christ, right, like colonization and like slavery, mm-hmm. You mentioned like human sin and abuse of that. Are there also more historical roots to those things? If that is a fruit, then what are the roots of that? Is it just sin, or would you say there's more to it?
Are there roots to, say, when it comes to, say, slavery or some of these other abuses? Are there other roots? Well, sure. I mean, certainly cultural factors. You also have certain political forces that are at work. Certain people who are misguided in their zeal for you think of the Inquisition and the quest for power, for keeping things doctrinally pure and so forth. I think that the sorts of things that are going on to explain what the Catholic Church was doing during the Inquisition and so forth are, in a sense, the same sorts of things that could explain other negative behaviors in other sociological contexts. And I would say, yes, human sinfulness is certainly at the root of these kinds of abuses. But in terms of any sort of biblical rootedness or something, I would say that this simply doesn't come out of, say, the New Testament teaching of Christ and so forth, that when someone is deviating, say, in sexual behavior in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul simply says, well, just remove him from the church. But that doesn't mean kill him, torture him, or something like that. But there's actually a concern for that person that even though he's being disciplined and he's not listening to the church and therefore needs to be removed from the community of the church, the goal is that he would eventually be restored. So there is actually a view to bring that person back eventually, that his spirit might be saved, Paul said. So that is the kind of concern that you see going on in the New Testament, and Paul certainly advocating, if it, insofar as it lies within you, live at peace with all people. So that's the kind of spirit that we ought to be taking away from, say, the New Testament, from Jesus, from Paul and others, evaluating what sorts of evils are done and rejecting them because they are a departure from that spirit. Yeah, so thank you.
Hi. So what I find really interesting and I really like about your house analogy is that I've been reading a lot about the dereliction of Christian values because I'm a philosophy student.
Do you say the dereliction?
Yeah, or the abandonment.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you have philosophers like Nietzsche who heavily influenced Hitler and a lot of the atrocities which happened in World War II, and like the dereliction of the abandonment of
Christian values. Yeah, that's fine. I understand dereliction. I just want to make sure. I just want to make sure I heard the word correctly. Yeah.
The abandonment of Christian values has been so evident, evidently like a massive influence in causing like atrocities to happen. And in relation to your house analogy, I find it very interesting that you say, when we abandon like Christian values, we're living in a house that has been built by Christian values that we don't appreciate. I just want to see your opinion on whether, to what extent you think we can regress as a society if we turn away from these Christian values.
Could you repeat that last sentence?
Regress. Like, how far can our society like regress? In our kind of non-appreciation of the house that we've built as a society.
Yeah, how far can it regress without, say, collapse or something like that? Or
That we are in a country that still has an established church, right. And clearly the laws of this country are very deeply rooted in Protestant Christianity. But in terms of our practice, we are far from being a Christian country, and congregations are progressively getting smaller. Right. So what effect might that have in terms of this country, but many others, certainly in Western Europe, as we move further away from the Christian religion worldview that has come to form the laws and the culture of the land? I don't know, does that...
Well, I mean, I think we're you know, I think starting to see... Well, I mean, the you know, we again we as we both landed on that analogy of the house. You know, I think just taking for granted a lot of these structures that have been in place when it comes to religious liberty and democracy, and failing to see that has actually transformed lives, that actually sacrificed to make these kinds of great gains. Those who are willing to sit by the bedside of a dying person and so forth, and not simply going to protest nuclear arms or something like that. So yes, that there is this disconnect, and I think that the further we're going more to a kind of mindset that Tacitus was talking about. He says the more corrupt the republic, the more laws. You know, we used to be able to, at least even growing up, a gentleman's agreement. You'd shake hands on something, and that was sufficient. You didn't need to sign any paperwork. Your word was your bond. And I think that as we see the lack of a worldview, a transformed life, the further away we're going to get from that character, the trustworthiness, the faithfulness, and so forth, and having to resort to legal matters to try to stay on top of people, to make sure that they finish the job that they had agreed to do and so forth, or else we take them to court or whatever, that we start to see slowly but surely an unraveling of these kinds of structures, these pictures of trust, these pictures of relationship, of patterns of character and faithfulness and so forth, that as we start to see these sorts of things deteriorating, I think we'll start to see greater lack of civility, greater self-absorption rather than concern for other people, that we'll start to see that that communities don't really, that I think a lot of the community that the Christian faith inspired, the volunteer organizations that the Christian faith inspired, that those sorts of things will start to fall away, that a lot of things that had sustained societies, not because you had the state supporting them, but you actually had people volunteering, stepping in, churches, being involved in the communities and so forth, that those sorts of things are no longer going to in a sense, offer that the oil of relationship and love and mentorship and so forth that the state simply cannot provide. So I think that those are the types of things where there'll be this kind of gradual unraveling, this kind of fraying, where the Christian faith had once been a great support in so many ways in society, and sustaining so much of our life in in our communities, kind of losing hold and people becoming more detached and fragmented and so forth. Those are just a few examples, but I think that that's the sort of thing that you start to see when we just, I think, take for granted the worldview, but don't have the sustaining power to keep it going. Yeah, thank you.
Good evening. Taking your point about the contribution of Christianity to democratic society and to the betterment of society in general, mm-hmm. and the fact that a number of people who were agnostic and or atheists, like mm-hmm. Rodney Stark, that you mentioned, saw through Christianity the positive. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I have a sort of multi-pronged question. First is, to what do you potentially attribute the increasingly antagonistic stance of society against Christians, needing to eliminate the Ten Commandments from any public place or having a manger scene or whatever, mm-hmm. Wearing a cross in public, etc.? All of these militant, increasingly antagonistic positions. And then as a church, do you feel that the church has become somewhat, shall we say, flabby because it...
Has become flabby, do you think?
Flabby, okay. Or out of shape or less, mm-hmm. Less strong, mm-hmm. Because of the fact that it has in the West been in a non-persecution phase, if you will, and that the persecution phase is sort of coming back, which will require a more definitive response. Mm-hmm. And do you think that response should be just going back to the first century model and dealing with, loving your neighbor, or should there be a more, shall we say, political response trying to get the government to act in a certain way?
Yeah, great question. Great questions. I would say, first of all, that yes, I think the church can become very flabby when we depend upon political power and don't see that fundamentally whoever is in power, whoever is in charge, the church needs to be doing its work as salt and light in a rotting and darkened world. And so we need to, I think, recover that mission of not becoming dependent upon political power. I'd say, sure, use political power for good. We think of William Wilberforce, who did that here in England, and what a wonderful example that is of using political power to set prisoners free. And so that is very appropriate. So we would use whatever means are available at our disposal. It doesn't mean withdrawal. I think it is precisely because Christians engaged in society, they shared their faith, they saw transformation, they helped those beyond their own sphere of kin, and they buried the dead of others. When a plague came to a city, they would be burying the dead and sometimes succumbing to the plague themselves. They would take in children who were left to be exposed, abandoned, and they would take them in and adopt them on their own. It was precisely because they were involved in a much broader vision than just their own private lives that the Christian faith made such a dramatic impact. And so I'd say, yes, we need to recover that sort of a mindset to continue to engage in as widely as possible, to engage in science, to engage in learning, to engage in the political, to engage in whatever vocation we have, to do everything to the glory of God and to honor God through that vocation. So I wouldn't say that going back to some sort of a cloistered community is the solution, like the Amish people in America or something. We are to be indeed world engaging. We are to be distinct from the ethic, the mindset, the worldview that is around us. But it is critical, for us to, I think withdrawal is not the solution. It is precisely because the salt as someone has put it, needs to get out of the salt shaker and into the world. And to preserve society, we can expect the society to rot if we're not influencing it. But if we pull back, well, why should we be surprised if things are in such great decline? When it comes to the whole issue of persecution and so forth, I think that sometimes the persecution, the hardship, the pushing back can actually sharpen us. We can become a more committed people rather than the flabby Christians that you talked about, precisely because it is Jesus said to expect suffering, to expect hardship that has been granted to us not only to believe in Christ, but also to suffer for his name. So Jesus said, don't be surprised if the world hates you. It hated me too. But we want to make sure that we're hated precisely because we are followers of Jesus, not because we're following some sort of a misguided methodology or strategy or something like that. So those are a few reflections on some of the questions that you've offered, but thank you very much.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a very, very good talk. And I completely agree that Christianity has made a big impact in the human civilization across the whole, East or Europe and other areas. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder whether your conclusion is oversimplified in a way. I think two things I pick up. One is you pick up one thing is about culture. So you recognize some culture, all culture is sick, and some culture is more sick than the others. That's a very interesting thought. Mm-hmm. And the other one linked, I think you're talking about this root, shoot, and fruit.
Right.
And so that indication of, for example, you give example of Hinduism, that means Hinduism is more sick than our culture or than European culture, for example. And that's my, I think, at least from the presentation, they're suggesting, for example, a rape, mainly probably a deep root, is behind the Hinduism culture and Hinduism root. But I just wonder if, I'm not a Hinduism, I'm not a Hindu, but I just wonder whether, for some people, maybe here are Hindu or have Hindu friends or relatives, maybe they think, well, that's not what Hindu teach them to do, but just maybe when you use examples of these pictures there, whether it's just metaphors, lots of metaphors used in Bible, for example, people shouldn't take literally. Not, I certainly don't believe Hinduism encourages people to rape, for example. And so that's my command. I don't know what's your thought about it.
Yeah. No, I appreciate your asking that question. Keep in mind that what I'm trying to do is emphasize how ideas have consequences, how the voices that we listen to shape the way that we not only think about things, but also how we what we actually carry out in our own everyday lives. What I want to emphasize is, I'm certainly not saying that all Hindus think this, but I'm saying at the very heart of Hindu theology is this very, again, this oppressive, these oppressive male deities that are lustful, they engage in rape, they engage in fornication of women and so forth. And there, as Kancha Ilaya said, there is no proper understanding within Hindu theology and Hindu culture even of of male-female equality. Well, should we be surprised at that? Should we be surprised when there are people who, when there is such rampant rape? Well, not necessarily. I mean, we're glad when they don't rape, when men treat their wives as equals and so forth. Wonderful. But all I'm trying to do is draw these sorts of connections and say that these are worldview shaped ideas because of listening to model voices, and that these will have consequences. So in a sense, I'm not trying to. I'm certainly not on the attack of Hinduism, but I've actually used Hindus themselves, like Ambedkar, who wrote the Indian Constitution, who rejected the Book of Manu. I'm referring to who was influenced by Jesus, by the way, Mahatma Phule, who saw Jesus, as the sacrifice king, as someone who was an appropriate model for India as opposed to what the Book of Manu teaches and the example of the Brahmins, who are, you know, who are trampling underfoot the those who have no caste and so forth. So I'm actually appealing to voices within India that highlight, that have highlighted the problem in a very profound way. Our son Peter was in India for 20 months, and he has certainly come back with many of these reports that really reinforce this profound structural ideological problem within Hinduism. So I would say this is just the reality that I'm in many ways speaking just very descriptively about this and saying, well, it's not surprising that you would have this sort of a thing.
Same time, there's a delay. in the same time, I think probably if you talk to people who are scholars of Hinduism, they probably have the other angle to explain why they describe that way. Of course, I think sometimes if you look into that evidence towards that one, then you always find evidence supporting a view. Yeah. But I just wonder, probably there are other evidence suggesting actually, you know, when writing that, it had different meaning or different explanation or something.
I appreciate your pushing back. I would say that you will find people who probably are at the upper level of Hindu society who would say, yeah, everything's great. But just ask the people who are living in these caste, you know, or lower caste or no caste situations, and then come talk to me. You know, I've been to India a number of times. I spent a summer in India in 1984. I've been to these places. I've certainly interacted with people from from Hindu backgrounds and so forth. But it is not those who are the oppressed ones who are actually talking about the glories of Hinduism. They want to get out of this oppressiveness. Part of the negatives of Hinduism is that, you know, in this sense, is that those who are oppressed are, they believe that they have, that they are this way because of what they had done in a previous life. And if you want to try to help them, then you actually may be jeopardizing your karma in the next life when you're reincarnated in another body. And so it ends up kind of immobilizing people. Why should I help someone who is this way because he deserves it from a previous life? I may actually bring harm to my own status in the next life, and so therefore I'm not going to help this person. My friend Tom Wolfe talked about one group of Dalits that are not allowed to be seen or heard. And so they live in their hovels all day, and they can only come out at night. And if a Brahmin hears that, you know, the people from that, that group of Dalits, Brahmin hears them out at night, he could justifiably tear down their home because he is part of that higher structure than those who don't have that kind of power. You talk about equal access. You go to Hindu temples. They're not going to allow those people in. It's only the people from the upper class who can come in, because if you're not a Brahmin, you're probably not going to be allowed. You're inevitably not going to be allowed to go into those temples unless it's only token. So that's the sort of reality that people every day are dealing with in India. So those are a few reflections, given my experience and conversations about this. So hopefully that's helpful.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
Q is drying up. I'll ask one question and see if anyone has a last burning question. And it's this, that looking forward, and or the present, but what the immediate future might hold in a world where the world is getting smaller, we're all extremely connected, it's the world of Twitter and Instagram, and it's very immediate, and you can find, and it's the world of post-truth, we've now created a phrase, where you can find a belief system for everyone. And you can find someone whose worldview happens to coincide with, or their worldview is one that you'd like to move towards. Mm-hmm. And it feels very fragmented. Mm-hmm. We're all closer together, but the ideas are much more transient and much less monolithic than Christendom of the Middle Ages or the Roman Empire or even 17th century Enlightenment had. What does that lens do to how you would view your views on what Christianity has done for us in terms of what it might do for our children and our children's generation.
Yeah, I mean, the whole issue of fragmentation and individualization and indeed kind of a virtual reality creation, or people saying, this is what I choose to believe, this is true for me, this is my truth. Well, the Christian faith has always maintained that what we see in the gospel of God becoming human, of God rescuing human beings, of God in Christ dying for the sins of the world so that there could be a reconciliation between us and God, and that the claims that Jesus made for himself about being the final judge of all, of being the one who had the ability to forgive sins and so forth, that these were vindicated by his resurrection from the dead, that his, and this is something that the early Christians took as a historical event, that there would be no Christianity, Paul says. There's no, if Christ has not been raised, our faith is futile. So they took it very seriously that the Christian faith is anchored in this event in history. As one church historian, Yaroslav Pelikan, said, if Christ has been raised from the dead, nothing else matters. He says, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, nothing else matters. That's how seriously the Christians took it, that this defining event in history was something that ought to shape our thinking, and that even if people are coming up with their own, this is what I think of Jesus, well, you're actually out of touch with certain historical realities, and what we ought to be doing is pointing people to the, again, the objective reality of the of this historical faith that is a knowledge tradition. It's not denying knowledge. It's actually saying, if you reject this, you're actually believing something that is false. And for those who would believe in reality creation, I'd say, well, how's that working for you in some ways? So not only is it the Christian faith true, but its denial actually leads to individual self-destruction. It leads to a lack of human flourishing. It leads to a fundamental dysfunction of our lives. If I can give an example, I was speaking at a conference a few years ago, and someone came up to me afterwards. I was speaking on this topic of relativism and the whole issue of fragmentation. And this person who came up to me, he said, you're describing exactly what I was like. He says, I was a relativist. I believe that that's just true for you, but not for me. And I was dating a girl who was, eventually said goodbye to me because she couldn't live with someone who didn't have any character, didn't believe in right and wrong, couldn't commit himself to anything. And it was really a great blow for me. And he said it is actually when she broke up with me that I started to actually take the truth seriously, that this was a cataclysmic moment for my in my life. And so he started to kind of rebuild his life, to take truth seriously, to take trust and relationship seriously, to take objective moral values seriously. And he said that his life eventually came together. He found Jesus Christ and was transformed by that message. And he said, and you see that woman sitting over there? He said, that's my wife. But she was the one who initially told me that she didn't want to be with me because I was living in such a self-centered way. And it was actually the gospel that brought us together. And so we are now serving Christ together in community. And it was a wonderful picture of how there could be this kind of transformation. So in the midst of all the fragmentation, in the midst of all the denial of the Christian faith, in the midst of all of this relativism, we find that this simply is not the way that we are wired to live. And I think reinforcing how the gospel and what I've been doing in this talk is the gospel and the Christian faith not only makes sense intellectually, it also helps us to understand how we ought to live our lives day by day, that we're wired for relationship, we're wired to be seekers of truth, we're wired to be people who seek the transcendent and so don't simply live for themselves. And when you find that this is how we're wired to live, when it all fits together, that we live in this world that God has made for us to, in a sense, to be enchanted by or to be humanized by the gospel. I think this is the sort of thing that we ought to be teaching our kids, we ought to be teaching within our community, that there is power in the gospel and in its capacity through Jesus Christ to have our lives transformed. Thank you.